This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey there. Before we get into today's episode, I have a quick ask. We're working on some special episodes of NPR's It's Been a Minute, and we want to have you on the show. That is if you are a guy and a member of Gen Z. I'm looking for men ages 18 to 24 to join me for a roundtable. We're going to talk all about the gender divide and how it shows up in dating, your economic outlook, your hopes for the future, and the politics of your peers. If you're interested in coming on the show, email ibam@npr.org. That's ibam@npr.org. I can't wait to hear from you. All right, on to the show. Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. It feels like any time Austin Butler stars in anything, people cannot help but talk about his accents. The latest, Dune Part 2, where it seems like he's doing a Stellan Skarsgård impression.
May thy knife chip and shatter.
And who can forget the accent he seemed to be unable to shake? Elvis.
Well, you may go to college. You may go to school.
Now, Austin Butler. Incredible actor, but all the chatter about his accent and impressions made me want to revisit our conversation about the case for bad accents. And it all started with a headline. You know, every once in a while I read something that makes me so mad, I have to click it immediately. And this one was an article from the New York Times titled, "There's No Such Thing as a Bad Movie Accent." That can't be true. He must be tripping. It got me so worked up that I had to call up the author, Kyle Buchanan. Kyle, with a headline like that, I feel like you're just inviting ire. Like you're just trying to make people mad.
Oh, yeah. I know what I was getting into there. And actually, I think the fun of posing that idea and titling the article that is that immediately in your head, you think, well, that can't be true. I'm thinking of this bad accent or this actor who couldn't do that accent. And then when you read it, I think I might convince you that actually it's kind of fun no matter what.
And while he isn't talking about the super offensive accents voiced by white actors in yellowface, blackface, or brownface, I'm thinking of Breakfast at Tiffany's or West Side Story, a bad accent is still bad. You mean to tell me that I'm just supposed to be okay with Lady Gaga's Italian accent in House of Gucci?
What I cannot wrap my head around is people who steal just for ego or the pleasure of it.
Last year, we added a new bad accent to the Great Hall of Bad Accents. Uma Thurman in the gay rom-com Red, White, and Royal Blue.
As soon as she comes on screen doing her accent, if you can recoil and lean forward at the same time, that's what I was doing.
I sent you to London with some pretty simple instructions. Represent the family at the royal wedding and don't cause an international incident.
And at first I was thinking to myself, I don't know about this. This is big. This is a capital C choice. But then I found myself missing her when she was gone.
Before this weekend, I had a higher approval rating than the prime minister. Hell, I was out polling the Spice Girls. And overnight, you've managed to undo all that.
As the movie went on, I didn't really care what happened to the two lead characters and their romance. Like, to me, the most suspenseful thing about this movie is how Uma Thurman was going to pronounce any given word. I guess I thought initially, I don't know that this is a good accent. But then I thought, if it gives me this much pleasure, can it really be bad?
Kyle is going to defend bad movie accents. And in the end, all of us are going to walk away with a new way of thinking about what an accent on screen really does for us. Kyle, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thanks for having me, Brittany.
Okay, so you are in Venice right now.
I am.
Very chic. Number one, I'm jealous. Number two, that means you're surrounded right now by Italian accents. Can I hear your Italian accent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just a little something real quick. I mean, don't worry, none of us is going to judge you.
Well, see, if I'm going to do a real Italian accent, I'm going to break all the levels in this mic, because Italians around me are, they're not afraid to get loud. So they'll be like, ciao, 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 buongiorno. They are on 11 from 6 a.m. on. You know, it's like a jolt of cappuccino.
Well, I appreciate the little bits of accent that you gave me just now. That chow sounded very authentic to me.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I think I would give your accent like a 6.5 out of 10 just now.
I'm honored.
I would say that's a higher score than any of the accents that we're going to talk about today. So here's the thing about a bad accent for me. If I'm watching a movie and the accent is so off, I'm like, where is this person supposed to be from? Like, it takes me out of a place. And to drive home this point, I want to play a little game with you.
Ooh, hit me, hit me.
Okay, so the name of the game is, where is she from? I'm going to play some quotes from famously bad accents.
Okay.
And you have to guess what region this actor is trying to depict. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And you get bonus points if you can name the actor and what movie it's from. Okay. So are you ready to play?
I will do my best.
Okay. Here's the first one.
Okay.
Excuse me, officers. My car broke down up the street there, and I was wondering if y'all could help me out.
Well, yes, ma'am. We'll be happy to.
Oh, you're sweet.
All right. Where is she from?
Where is she from? You know, she is definitely from the South. Maybe a South that she only really knows from watching episodes of True Blood.
Jessica Simpson, who is famously from Texas, in the movie Dukes of Hazzard.
If we're talking about crazy movie accents, sometimes it doesn't matter if you're actually from the place. You know, there's a movie, Cold Mountain, with Nicole Kidman and Jude Law. You know, they're British actors doing Southern accents. And into this movie strides Renee Zellweger, who's actually from the South. And her accent is so big that you'd be forgiven for wondering if she was the faker.
Old Lady Swanger says you need help. Here I am.
It sounds like she's the one putting on the accent. But you know, that bigness really works for that movie. It definitely gives that film a jolt when it needs it.
Well, okay, so far you have not guessed where she's from, but maybe you'll get it with this next one.
No beer, sister, no devil, no dopey. Everything gonna be iry, rotted. Or be evil, I not evil, oh man. No man, I on holiday.
Brad Pitt in Meet Joe Black, am I right?
Ding, ding, ding. And where is she from in this film?
I think he's trying to do a Jamaican accent. Is he succeeding at it? Well, I don't know. But let me tell you, Brittany, I have never forgotten that moment. How long has it been since Meet Joe Black came out? At least 15 years.
At least.
Boy, when you played that clip, it was like I had just seen it yesterday.
Well, ding, ding, ding. You got it right on all counts. That was absolutely Brad Pitt. Regretfully, Brad Pitt doing Jamaican, trying to speak in a Jamaican accent, some Jamaican patois in Meet Joe Black. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Well, I got one more for you.
Good.
I'm hoping that you get this one, but let's just see what happens. Let's hear this next one.
Okay.
Come on, let's go to Paris's. I want to rob.
Where is she from?
That's only one of the most quotable lines of the last 20 years, in my opinion. That is Emma Watson in Sofia Coppola's The Bling Ring. And she is doing Valley Girl. And I think doing it really effectively. I don't think she's ever been as fun in any movie. You can put the Harry Potter movies aside as well, as she is in that movie. And I, as a native Southern Californian, recognized it immediately. If she went a little over the top, I don't mind at all. As the director Joel Schumacher once said, nobody ever paid to see under the top.
You know, I also wonder if a bad accent tells us something about our own stereotypes that we put on places. I mean, I only really knew about Valley Girl accents from somebody telling me what a Valley Girl accent sounded like. Like Emma Watson in The Bling Ring, some people think is bad, but Alicia Silverstone in Clueless is like thought of as, you know, universally good.
Oh, as if.
Is determining good versus bad giving all of us like a false sense of authority over a place? Like, I mean, you know, someone, like you said, you could judge between the two like Valley Girl accents, but someone like me or somebody else who, you know, who's never been to the Valley and never even spoken to someone from the Valley might decide to like judge based on stereotype. Do you think in some ways we're just regurgitating stereotypes of a place when determining good versus bad accents?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there are so many stories of actors, you know, doing reams of research to try to nail a voice, a character, working with dialect coaches. But I think also they're probably plucking ideas they have in the air, right? I mean, if I asked you, Brittany, to do a British accent, would you be doing a British accent based on British people you know? Or would you be doing it on the time you watched Mary Poppins when you were 10?
I don't think anybody wants to hear either of those attempts from me.
Oh, you did make me do an Italian accent, so I wouldn't mind.
Oh my God. See, I would say for me that an accent is good when it accurately depicts like what I imagine someone from that place to sound like. Like whether it's Frances McDormand doing a Minnesota accent. See, I said it, Minnesota accent in Fargo, or Renee Zellweger doing British accent in Bridget Jones' Diary, which in my mind, mostly American actors butcher British accents, but Renee Zellweger, baby, she turned it out in Bridget Jones' Diary. Or Ugandan British actor Daniel Kaluuya doing any number of American accents.
Anything.
In Get Out or Nope or any of the other films that he's been in. To me, a good accent is when I'm like, oh yeah, I totally believe that you're from this place, even if I've never been there.
That's exactly it, Brittany. And I think that leap, the believing, is what I'm interested in when I hear a movie accent. We don't necessarily know because we haven't always been to these places. Part of the fun of a movie is playing pretend and making us believe that we're there. You know, I mean, if somebody was doing an Icelandic accent, then I'm sure viewers in Reykjavik would have their own opinions of it. But I don't go to movies with a red pen. Mm-hmm. I go to be entertained. And if they're doing a somewhat more entertaining version of an Icelandic accent, well, who am I to argue if I'm enjoying it?
You know, you bring up, though, a few interesting points. And one of the things it makes me think of is how accents, like, are shaped. In this case, it makes me think about this interview that we did with Christine Baranski last year, who was taught how to change her voice so she could change how people saw her. We're all familiar with how Christine Baranski talks now. She has this beautiful, crisp, pristine diction. But she was saying that when she first arrived at Juilliard, they did early recordings of her.
And I kind of sounded like a girl from the Midwest with a very nasal voice. I hardly sounded like this. We learned the kind of classical speech for theater.
And that kind of reminds me, even the way that she speaks, is of the transatlantic accent. It was like taught in prep schools in the late 19th and early 20th century as a kind of like a blend between American and British vocal styles. Like ultimately, that accent was meant to show status and it was meant to demonstrate wealth and sophistication. I think that kind of gets at how we stereotype through accents. Like if you speak a certain way, you know, it can say something to somebody else about your class, race, sexuality, region, culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you talk about this, I'm thinking about my own personal history with my own voice. It's interesting. I'm a gay man, and I think that I have met a lot of other gay people from all over the country. They'll come from Texas, they'll come from New York, places that you would normally associate with stronger accents, and the rest of their family will have accents, and they won't. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it isn't because gay men, when they're growing up, to avoid being bullied, have to police their own voice to some extent. Mm. There's a little bit of changeability that's drummed in you from an early age about how you sound. So, you know, listening to that anecdote about Christine Baranski and the way she changed her voice until it just sort of froze that way, you know, I do think that absolutely, yeah, you know, the way you sound, the accents that people can or can't pick up on have some sort of associations in the cultural mind. Absolutely. You know, I personally, in my own voice, when I talk, I just hear the Southern Californian that I am. sometimes I have people ask me if I'm British, if I'm Australian, and I just reply, no, I'm gay and pretentious.
I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Michigan, southeastern Michigan. I used to say fur, sure. I still say it a lot. But I didn't realize that I said fur like that all the time until I was like, oh my God, girl, you got to think something about this. This is a little country.
But that's so endearing.
But yeah, I mean, these things do kind of change. Sometimes we're conscious of them and sometimes we're not. I wonder, when you hear someone like Uma Thurman, who's playing a U.S. president in Red, White, and Royal Blue, does her bad accent actually give a new perspective on what it means to be Southern? Like, does the way she speaks in some way break the stereotype of the South that some people hold and give us a chance to think about Southerners differently?
It is incredible. I do think that, Brittany, if you asked me to do a Southern accent now, which you should absolutely not do, I would immediately think of Uma and I would be trying to aim there.
Do you think an accent like Uma Thurman's should just stay on the big screen, or do you wish more people would adopt her accent in real life?
You know, there's an accent that I mentioned in the article, which is a clip of Sienna Miller on stage doing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Living with someone you love can be lonelier than living entirely alone if the one that you love doesn't love you.
It is wild. It is so out of pocket. I cannot possibly describe it. And yet, if I heard real people talking like that, I'd be compelled. And you start to think, well, if some of the people don't actually sound like that, maybe they should consider it. It's awfully entertaining. I know that much.
Well, Kyle Buchanan, thank you so much for joining me today. This was so much fun.
Anytime, Brittany.
That was Kyle Buchanan. He covers pop culture for the New York Times. Coming up, while Kyle didn't believe in bad accents, there's definitely such a thing as bad sex. But as a culture, why have we come to accept or even expect that? I revisit my conversation with an author who says we all have a part to play in making it better.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
A quick warning to listeners, this conversation is entirely about sex. And not just any sex. Sex that's just kind of mid. Unsatisfying sex. Bad sex. We may have made the case for bad accents, but bad sex is something else altogether. This conversation was from last year, but sadly, it's still relevant. Bad Sex is the title of a book that gets into the causes of lackluster sex. Mental, emotional, historic, and systemic. And the author really changed how I thought about being a woman who's dated and loved men.
It's about the unfinished business of the sexual revolution, especially when it comes to female desire.
That's Nona Willis Aronowitz. She wrote the book as she was leaving an unsatisfying marriage and re-entering the world with a big libido and a lot of questions. Like, how do you discover your true desires when sexism seeps into sex?
And while I was on this personal journey, I was also reading a lot of history.
Nona found that for centuries, women who date men have grappled with balancing safety and respect with love and pleasure.
That's honestly a through line that I saw through every generation of activists, where you have these feminists who are trying to imagine a better future for themselves, but they're actually living in the present and dealing with people who have been socialized in the past.
Stick around, because Nona will unpack the histories and the intimacies of what it's like to be a woman who spent a lot of time thinking about how to have good sex with men.
So I want to get, I guess, a definition of terms. Define what you mean by bad sex.
Well, so the bad sex of the title, I think, has a few meanings. One, it refers to the sex that I had in my marriage, which a lot of people seem to be very shocked about. They're like, I can't believe you're talking about the bad sex in your marriage. Poor Aaron, or whatever. For the record, he's fine with it and also knows that we had bad sex. We talked about it all the time. And I'm not saying that he was bad in bed. I'm saying we had bad sex. So I think that bad sex can just be a bad connection, a bad, like a lack of chemistry, and also just a lack of communication of what you want. Because sometimes you don't even know what you want, even with the most well-meaning partners. But then, you know, it also means something broader. It means sex that's not satisfying for all kinds of reasons, because people are still stuck in a dynamic of like men are the pursuer and women are the gatekeepers, because people have different motivations that cause them to accept bad sex or bad relationships. There are all kinds of elements of sexism and misogyny that threaten to undermine our pleasure. Like, it gets broader and broader.
How would you describe the sex landscape at the moment, especially for women who date men, and the kind and quality of sex they're accepting?
I think we're in a bit of a backlash to the sort of flattened, mindless sex positivity of the 90s and aughts. And now, I think as Gen Z is getting a little older, we're in a full-fledged rethinking of what sex positivity really can and should mean. I think for a while, there was this vibe of like, get it, girl, you know, get your orgasms, like, you know, have sex with whoever you want and you're liberated. And then starting maybe, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, that narrative started to become more and more complex. We had very hard conversations about sexual assault, and not only sexual assault, just sort of encounters that didn't make women who date men feel good. You know, I'm thinking of Aziz Ansari, I'm thinking of Cat Person,
right.
And it's not like sex is getting worse per se. It's just that our standards are really high, and yet we still haven't figured out how to meet that high standard. And sometimes that high standard itself can create shame and disappointment. And so I think we're at a really weird moment where we know we're supposed to, you know, have sexual pleasure or feel romantic fulfillment, but we don't necessarily know how to get there. And some people are just opting out altogether.
One of the things I really liked about the book is that in the way that you define and discuss bad sex, you really accomplished two things that I had been wanting, I think, out of writing around sex, which is one, you frame bad sex as simply unsatisfying, as opposed to lumping it in with experiences that were harmful or coercive or abusive. Like, sometimes it feels like the sex that women have with men is framed in terms of painful or harmful, or simply consensual, or multi-orgasmic, without really anything in between or beyond that. I also appreciated the fact that this wasn't a book about sex tips. It was about like how we got here. There's something with a much longer history and a lot more nefarious at play than just, you know, I'm having this experience that doesn't feel that great. How did the sexual revolution of the 60s and second wave feminism miss the mark when it came to good sex for women who have sex with men?
Ooh, let's see if I can distill this. I think, yes, the pill sort of pushed it along because it removed the inevitability of pregnancy. And that was huge for women, I think very right. liberating for them. But from the beginning, it was sort of freeing sex and freeing the stigma of sex through a male lens. Like, all of a sudden, you wouldn't be shamed for having, let's say, premarital sex or sex with more than one person. But the actual sex was still prioritizing men's desires, and women still didn't really know how to discover their desires on their own terms. And then the feminists came around, and I think, like I said, in those early days, sexual desire was taken extremely seriously, and there was a lot of imagination and energy around that topic. And then what happened in the 70s is the feminist movement became very preoccupied with rape and danger and protecting women from men's violent impulses, which is, of course, extremely important. But what I think ultimately got lost was those things needed to be balanced with the pursuit of pleasure. And there were pro-sex feminists that were advocating for this, of course. My mother was an early radical pro-sex feminist. Her name was Ellen Willis. And she was in sort of those very early consciousness-raising sessions that really kicked off the more radical, the more imaginative, the less sort of like corporate version of feminism in the late 60s. But I think what the culture really glommed onto was like the paradigm of rape and, you know, anti-domestic violence and take back the night. And again, all those things were transformative in terms of protecting women from violence. But I think they overshadowed and drowned out the voices who were trying to prioritize female pleasure. And then from there, I think it's just been very difficult to have that conversation and then also have the sexual assault, danger, consent conversation and have them sort of seamlessly intertwine. I think we still struggle with that to this day.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like there's so much between sex shouldn't hurt, right? Or sex should be wanted and something agreed upon by everybody. And sex should feel good. Sex should be fun.
I also do think that there's an uncomfortable conversation to be had about danger being part of pleasure and risk being part of pleasure. I think, you know, the sort of campus consent movement or like the, you know, consent is sexy thing is like really well-meaning, but it does sort of ignore the fact that some people are turned on by uncertainty or games or even violence or some sort of risk taking. And I think that for a lot of people, that's always going to be part of their sexual makeup. And maybe that's cultural and socialized, what's nature and what's nurture. But I do think that like completely safe sex, emotionally safe, physically safe, is like not necessarily going to be hot for some people.
You talked to men, and you explored men's reactions to the sexual revolution and second wave feminism. It seemed, at least at this time, that like women were expected to change their attitudes towards sex, lest they be called frigid, or women were seeking a more equitable approach to sex. And there were some men that were hip to that, but most men didn't have to change their attitudes or didn't have to think about changing their attitudes about having sex with women. Like, has that dynamic shifted at all in today's world?
I think so. I mean, I think let's give men a little bit of credit. I think there are a lot of men out there who are trying to be good partners, trying to give women pleasure during sex. Mm-hmm. But I do think that even those well-meaning guys have a lot of internalized misogyny. And I think it's really hard to fully absorb just how much you need to be conscious and how much you need to sort of deprogram your own misogyny as a man. Like, because you're just steeped in it from the very beginning of your life. We all are. That's happened to me a lot where I'm sort of just interrogating my own upbringing. And I'm like, well, I was raised by like two radical leftists. And still I've really absorbed some bad cultural messages.
You know, after having so much bad sex throughout a long relationship, I was really blown away by the rigorous testing you did of your sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I really mean that seriously. Like, it was an interrogation of self as much as it was going out into the world and seeing what you really responded to. How did you go about, during that process, determining what was compulsory and what you actually wanted?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a journey. Like, it, I guess, started with, here I am, I'm single, I'm 32. A lot of people around me are sort of already married and maybe thinking about having kids. And then there is this whole other set of people who decided not to do that yet or ever. And mm-hmm. I all of a sudden felt like, okay, I'm part of this like different club now, somebody who stepped off the heterosexual conveyor belt to like discover their desires.
Mm-hmm.
And I started having sex with a lot of people, and I was having sex with other people when I was in my relationship because of our non-monogamy, and also because, I mean, frankly, some of that was like plain old cheating. And both of those things have totally different norms than just like normal dating, you know? And then I started to sort of question my heterosexuality.
Right.
I started to sort of think that was, in some sense, weird that I had had so much bad sex with men, and yet I still assumed I was heterosexual. And I had never really interrogated actively why I wanted to have sex with men in the way that I think many queer people sort of by default have to do. Like, they have to go through sort of an active process because the default of society is being heterosexual. And then if you're not, you have to be like, what are my desires? And I sort of took a cue from that style and really gave it some thought of like, what about men do I desire? And like, why do I want to have sex with them? And why do I want to love them? Mm-hmm. Especially when there's so much like, you know, complication and rancor sort of mixed in there. Like, what makes it all worthwhile? And that was actually really enlightening. That was kind of like one of the major aha moments of the book, of like, hetero people should really be thinking about why they're hetero, just like any other desire, you know?
I want to talk about this one chapter where you talk about the problems of heterosexuality and how there's this response that's discussed seriously and alternatively tossed around as a joke, where heterosexual women should give up men altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that this doesn't serve hetero people or lesbians. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, well, I think the word on the street, the term that explains that is heteropessimism. That was coined by Asa Saracen a few years ago. And it really, yeah, like you said, like people are genuinely sort of like anti-hetero, but even hetero people are sort of like facetiously anti-hetero in this very defeatist way that I find to be incredibly annoying, but also just not useful at all.
Right.
It's very defeatist. It's kind of denying your own desires to say, I'm hetero, aka I want to have sex with and love men, I guess if you're a woman, and yet like, I don't like those men. I don't trust those men. Heterosexuality is doomed and ha, ha, ha. Well, it's like, it's not that funny and it's not that cool to say, I desire this thing, but I'm not going to try to make it better. Once I did sort of determine that I was mostly heterosexual, it's my responsibility to continue to make those relations better, like either with my writing and activism or just on an individual level. Like, I can't just talk about men like they're trash because like I'm supposedly like them. I supposedly love them. Why are you treating the people you're supposedly like wanting to love and have sex with so badly? So I think that that's like step one in improving heterosexuality, just like not being ashamed of your own desires. I think that's really part of it.
You also mentioned, too, that, like, there is some homophobia inherent, too, in the idea that, like, someone can or should just begin having sex with you know, people that they're not inherently attracted to.
Right, right. And yeah, that's the other element, is that queer people are humans too. They can be jerks also. They can be bad at relationships. They can hurt you. You can have bad sex in queer relationships also. And I think that that's sort of like not taking queer people seriously. I think a lot of queer people find heteropessimism extremely annoying also. And if you're hetero, don't idealize like another type of relationship. Try to have the best hetero relationship you can have, and don't give up politically on the project.
You know, so much has changed, even honestly, since this book was published. Shortly after your book came out earlier this year, we saw the overturn of Roe versus Wade, which rolled back abortion access in many states across the country, which also greatly affects and changes the social consequences of sex for many people. You have a chapter that unpacks abortion and pregnancy termination in the book. How are you thinking about the bad sex conversation now, I guess, in this like post-Roe world?
I mean, I think the simplest way to put it is there is no sexual liberation without reproductive freedom. Like, it does not exist. And abortion has always existed. But legal abortion, really, one thing it did do was further separate pleasure from reproduction. But this certainly puts a huge, huge, huge onus on people with uteruses who decide to have sex for pleasure or any other reason. Yes, of course, there were conservative forces who did not want abortion to be legal, but there were also supposedly liberal forces talking about, you know, the worst cases of people who had miscarriages who can't get care, or like people who had fetal abnormalities who can't get, you know, third trimester abortions. But for the vast majority of people who get abortions, it's simply because they're choosing a different life, and they're often choosing what's going to make them happier at that moment. And I think that abortion is a huge part of preserving the pursuit of happiness, which is just, in my opinion, another way of saying the pursuit of pleasure.
You know, we've spent all this time talking about bad sex. What is good sex, and how can we have it?
Oh, God. Well, that's the million-dollar question, Brittany. But I think the broadest answer is sex in which you are extremely tuned into the other person's desires. Like, it's not enough for you to be having a great time, but you also have to have a sense that the other person is having a great time. And I think you can have that with a total stranger. You can have that with the love of your life. And it's like this beautiful dance where you're responding to each other's desires in this way that feels like you're very, very connected. And when they don't quite know, they ask. But often they know through other ways, like body language and vocalizations and like little things that they're observing and appreciating and loving about the person. And it does involve some, you know, kindness and tenderness and generosity, even if you're having like a super anonymous, like nasty encounter or whatever. Like, there's tenderness beneath it because you care whether the other person's having a good time.
Nona, thank you so much for joining us today. This was really great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Nona Willis Aronowitz. Her book, Bad Sex, Truth, Pleasure, and an Unfinished Revolution, is out now.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how a new study aims to impact an underrepresented community.
My greatest hope for the Voices of Black Women study is that it will help us understand and identify culturally tailored ways to change and really eliminate the unacceptable disparities for future generations of Black women as it relates to cancer.
To learn more, go to voices.cancer.org. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. It's Meredith. I'm wondering if you saw Beyoncé's post about her new album and that she didn't feel welcome in the country music scene. What do you think about that?
Hey, Meredith. Thank you so much for calling in with this question. So I did see Beyoncé's post about her new country music album, or what she calls a Beyoncé album, not a country album, but just... by the first two singles, it's very clear that what she is doing is releasing an album full of Beyoncé country music, and that's fine. But it's called Cowboy Carter. It comes out March 29th. So she says on this Instagram post that this album was born out of an experience that she had years ago where, in her words, I did not feel welcomed, and it was very clear that I wasn't. But she goes on to say, because of that experience, she did a deeper dive into the history of country music and studied our rich musical archive. Many people, including myself, believe that what she is referring to is her 2016 performance at the CMAs. It was the 50th anniversary of the Country Music Awards, and Beyoncé performed a song from her album Lemonade called Daddy Lessons with the Chicks. For those of you who don't know your country music history, the Chicks had been kind of all but blacklisted from traditional country spaces because of criticism that they had made openly about George W. Bush and his wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It had been years since these women had been at the CMAs, despite the fact that they literally used to be country music royalty, and they sound amazing together. It's just like four Texas girls rocking out to an amazing country song. I loved it. Now, despite the fact that they gave an incredible show, the clip of that performance did not show up on YouTube for at least another day. Even though other clips from that CMA's broadcast were going up on YouTube immediately, some people feel like that might have been because there are people who felt like Beyoncé was an interloper. And as a Black R&B and pop artist, she should stay out of their mostly white genre. It also didn't help that that same year she had just released Formation. You remember when she was wearing the Black Panther outfits performing at the Super Bowl, or perhaps when she sank a New Orleans Police Department cop car in the music video for that song. Yeah, they were not pleased. But as somebody who watched that performance and who watched the pans over the crowd and some of the close-ups and the audience, there were many a white country fan who were expressionless or looked tense or angry and just were not responding to that performance at all. Since then, Beyoncé hasn't really been seen in the country music space, but it seems like she's trying to come back with a vengeance. So I guess we'll just have to see what she gives us. But for now, I am not the least bit surprised that Beyoncé is giving the people something to chatter on about. But Meredith, thank you so much for calling in with this question. And I hope you have a boot scootin' weekend. Thank you so much. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Patrick Murray,
Josh Newell.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.